Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Trinity Talks. My name is Kyla.
I'm Jordana.
My name is Bill.
And I'm Johanna.
And we are continuing our podcast series where we're reflecting on the sermons or the teaching that just took place during our service. And today's topic is a little bit awkward, but also I think something that's really important and something that actually one of our viewers requested that we talk about this topic.
Even
before they knew about the sermon series.
Oh, okay.
So that I think shows that this is something that's important that people are thinking about and want to talk about. And that is lust. So before we dive into what lust is and sort of what that looks like, as I said, it's really awkward. It's hard to talk about. Yep. Why? What do we think makes this so hard for us to talk about? Bill?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean, because of all the seven deadly sins, I think this is the one that I relate to the least. So I really don't know what the big deal is or what we're talking about here. I'm like, this is just not an issue for me at all. I hope you got the sarcasm in my voice.
Yeah, the denial. Yes.
If you don't laugh, you're going to cry.
Yeah, so. I know.
Yeah. Johanna, what do you think makes this so hard to talk about?
Probably just our attitude towards it in general as a society is very like, you're either very for it and very brazen, just like, you know, go out and like hook up every day of the week, or you're very like prudish about it, almost is what it feels like.
Okay.
So then with everyone in the middle ground of like, I don't know, it's just whatever, then they feel uncomfortable because there's those extremist sides, I guess.
Yeah. It feels like we have to like be on one side or the other side. But actually, most of us are in the middle and just don't know what to say.
Yeah.
Or what to do.
Yeah.
I'd also say, you know, I mean, on the one hand, I completely agree with Johanna here. Like, I think that there are so many different ways of thinking about it, and some of them are very fraught. Mm-hmm. Right. And so you tend to avoid a conversation. But on a more healthy scale, too, I also think that sexuality, right, is very intimate, very personal. Chances of you just speaking openly about it with somebody who isn't a long-standing friend or a close family member are slim. And so even in that just the ordinary sense in which sexuality is very personal and private, like you tend to just avoid the conversation. And that is in a sense somewhat natural as well.
I think we just we just don't talk about sex.
Right.
Yes. I mean, even the healthy and appropriate sexual part of who we are as humans, it's just private. Awkward just to talk about it, even in a positive way. It's just
it's also kind of gross when you think about it.
Is it?
Like, it's kind of gross to talk about. I mean, you don't have to talk about the weird details, I guess, but like,
and that sort of points to how intimate it is, right, and how private it is. And so then maybe others don't want to hear about that level of intimacy with you, and so that ends up being a place where we are silent. We give up the opportunities to speak in healthy ways. I think that comes with the danger of not sometimes addressing it. Then it just feels like it's always related to some amount of shame or, but, and that's not the case in so many ways, but,
It doesn't have to be.
It doesn't have to be. Sorry. Yes, you're right. It doesn't have to be.
Yeah, for sure. So it's hard to talk about, but I think for the purpose of this conversation, it would be helpful for us to define lust, so that we know what it is that we're talking about. So one definition that I read that actually aligns closely with what Rob was saying in the sermon was that lust is treating people as objects for our own pleasure. So we're sort of denying the humanity of another person, and they're just becoming a thing that gives us some sort of pleasure. And that pleasure might happen just in our mind, or it might happen sort of through physical actions.
And just to unpack that a little bit, which also came out in Rob's sermon, was the sense that on the one hand, you reduce the full humanity of the other person, right? But by also only thinking about your own pleasure, you reduce the full humanity of yourself in relationship.
Yes.
Like sexuality or sex is inherently relational, right? Like you can, it's not just like another appetite. You can eat a meal alone. Right. You can't have necessarily sex alone. Like
you can't.
It's inherently relational, I think. I think you have to simulate something else. What I mean, if you're going to Anyway, let's go move away from the awkwardness. But what I'm saying is that, well, what I am saying is that that inherent relationality is the way, at least the Bible talks about, you know, people in relationship.
Sure. Yep.
And so to only reduce it to the your own sensation is also not bringing your whole self into relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be why I think you can objectify others, you can reduce yourself, the humanity of the other person is reduced, the humanity of yourself is reduced, and all of that seems to take place when we when we're talking about lust.
Yeah, thanks Jordana for saying that, because I think that I think a very similar kind of idea around that. I know when I'm in a state of lust, right? I mean, I just have a sense of that. I might not be able to define it, you know. But I kind of know when it's happening, and I think. But it's really helpful to be able to kind of spend some time thinking about it, and just kind of knowing yourself more around that. And I think when I have thought about it, it's. For me, it's really about relationship. And that's exactly what you talked about, was relationship. And lust damages and erodes relationship. Your relation to yourself, right? I mean, you become disassociated with yourself when lust takes a priority over your life. It's no longer healthy sexuality, but it's a preoccupying desire that's inappropriate, illicit. And it destroys self.
Yeah.
And I think also it destroys your relationships with other people, right? It destroys your relationships with other people that you're engaged in lust with, and ultimately it destroys your ability to be in relationship with everyone else, right? Because that sense of everyone is an object of your own desire.
Yeah.
You can't care and love for someone who is an object.
Yeah.
And so that's for me, it's a lot about relationship.
Yeah, for sure. So we are talking about lust primarily in terms of sexual desire, but I think it's fair to sort of point out that in our culture, in our vocabulary, we also talk about lust for other things sometimes, right?
Yep,
so we'll talk about lust for power. That's the first one that comes to mind. Are there other things that come to mind for folks when we think of lust?
Maybe I mean, not. That is the one that really first comes to mind, because, you know, it's that intensity of desire for something quite powerful.
Yep. Yep.
Right. Yep. And so, you know, and so, yeah, that is the first one. You can use lust in a different way.
Yeah.
Lust for pleasure is another one.
Sure.
Lust for any number of things.
Yeah.
But I mean, most of the time when you think about lust, or when people are talking about lust, it's of a sexual nature. And Rob said in the sermon today that, yes, there are other things you can lust for or lust after. But when it comes to the seven deadly sins, sorry, folks, we're talking about sex.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. So is there something about our current sort of North American Western culture that makes lust or sexuality more of a thing than it has been at other times and at other moments? It just seems to be really in your face, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
It's pretty normalized, I feel like.
Yeah. Okay.
Like, even the way that, like, people talk to each other, like, oh, just the way you can compliment someone, I guess. Like, you can call them beautiful or, like, intelligent or anything, like, actually nice. Or you could say that, like, their ass is nice. Like,
and just, you can say
like,
that?
Yeah, yeah. And that, I feel like that's kind
I'm
of
not
what.
Say that.
I feel like that's kind of how people compliment sometimes is probably like that. Or like just like in conversation with other people, like just derogatory language, I guess, is just normalized. It's just how people talk amongst each other for some certain settings.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Maybe in your generation more than Bill.
Maybe.
Yeah. Maybe I used to be able to say that. I don't. It is normalized for sure, but I think we're also in a very hyper-sexualized culture, where not only is it normal, but it is just in your face all the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I can't open, you know, Facebook or social media and stuff without having to scroll past, you know, you know, what is potentially kind of inappropriate, you know, videos or whatever, you know, these TikTok things or, and it's, but even beyond social media, just advertising and it just seemed like sex sells, right? I mean, that's like advertising 101. And so it's always being used to say, you know, that, you know, this is the way to go. This is the better life, you know, and it's accepted and normalized, and it erodes a lot of the healthy attitudes or healthy character that we need to have as a society.
It's constantly, like, I'm even thinking of Met Gala, you know, costumes sometimes, right? Like, it's just everywhere, and it's also sort of reframed as body positivity very often. Mm-hmm. And on the one hand, the whole notion of body positivity is meant to move away from that language of shame, right? But on the other hand, it is putting itself up completely as sexual in isolation of relationship, right? And so you've got, you know, I'm proud of my body and I will flaunt it sexually,
right?
You know, and that's different from I'm happy or grateful or proud or, you know, all of the healthy ways you can say I've received my body and it's God's gift. And there are so many ways to think about our bodies in a way that centers our dignity without necessarily thinking I have to flaunt sexuality. You know, and I think our culture sort of slips down that way, that route really easily. So it's everywhere. It's in every television show, every movie, right? It's, I mean, one sociologist called it the pornification of popular culture.
Right.
Like, it's just out there all the time.
Yeah.
It's actually hard to have healthy visions when it's just always in your face.
And I think, like, what I struggle with the most, maybe not the most, but one of the things that I struggle with is the way that, like, sex and sexuality is sort of positioned as, like, the ultimate good, right? As, like, if you just, like, have the right partner and they look the right way and you engage in the right acts, you will be the happiest that you could ever be in your life, right?
And
that's just, like, not true.
Nope.
And not helpful.
No, it's not helpful. And the flip side of that is if you don't have that right, all of that, you are incomplete, lacking, you know. And if you, as a Christian, go down that route, you have no way to contemplate Jesus and the disciples, right? Yep. Like, you know, you'd literally have to say without a happy family life, Jesus was lacking something or the disciples were lacking something. And so there is a, you know, I think, so it gets very difficult in this culture, which posits sex as ultimate fulfillment, as the space of your fulfillment, to actually have a healthy sense of wholeness outside of, you know, without necessarily going down that route.
I agree. I think we're created to be sexual beings, and there's a very healthy sense of sexuality that is part of who we are and makes up who we are. But I don't think that necessarily means that we have to have sex.
No.
Right? Or that, you know, that there's... So it'd be interesting to kind of think more about what it means to be a healthy sexual human being, and you know, what that would look like in different situations. Because it doesn't mean, you know, you're not lacking if you're not actually doing the act.
Yes,
I mean,
exactly.
You are still a sexual being,
yes,
and you can be healthy in that in your life, one way or the other. Yeah. I think anyway.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, in order to combat this problem of lust, I mean, Christian culture for a long time has recognized that this is a problem.
Yep.
And so they've kind of swung in the other direction to emphasize sexual purity, and in some cases, I think that is potentially helpful. You know, it encourages people to behave in particular ways that we might think of as more desirable, you know, waiting until marriage to have sex. But I think it also creates a number of other problems. So just in your own experiences and in sort of ways that you've thought about this, how does this problem of emphasizing sexual purity, like what challenges does that create?
So I think part of the problem with the purity culture element of of that Christian, you know, ethos is that it's reductive, mm-hmm. right? It, first of all, it thinks about sexual abstinence as pure, and with the implication, without ever actually saying it out, that maybe once you have sex, there's the issue of purity disappears
somehow less pure.
You know, yeah. less pure somehow. Yeah. It's just odd when you think about the positive nature of sex within the fact that God created it, right? And so that notion that you're pure by some kind of behavior,
right,
as opposed to, and then somehow the issue goes away, and just once you're married, is an odd dichotomy. It feels so strange. The language of purity in the Bible, I think, has been sort of misused in that case. Like, mm-hmm. God makes us pure because he washes away all our sins. Mm-hmm. It's not just in the area of sexuality, right? This means that it's an ongoing, you know, turning to Jesus, mm-hmm. receiving his grace and forgiveness, mm-hmm. being washed, you know, having your sins washed away. Those are things that happen throughout your life, within your marriage, outside your marriage, every area.
Right.
And so, you know, to actually say that the word pure only applies to this kind of sex, you know, area of sexuality is just very reductive. And it's not helpful. It's not helpful for people to recognize that battles with lust, battles with unhealthy relationships are going to be ongoing, whether you're married when you are married, right? And so it's really reductive about the possibilities of healthy, ongoing relationships, and can leave people really confused. Then when, you know, if the whole ethos is you're pure and wonderful if you abstain before marriage, and then anything goes in marriage, and then marriage doesn't work out that way. Right. It's really confusing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And then forget about it after marriage, like post-marriage.
If a marriage breaks
anything
up,
goes,
anything
that,
goes.
Right.
Right.
So you're talking about like if a marriage breaks up, right?
Yeah,
then
that's
like,
right. Yeah.
Then, what happened?
Oh, I was good. I was a good boy before I got married, and I was a good boy during my marriage, and unfortunately my marriage broke up. But now post-marriage. The
issue of purity is gone.
Anymore,
exactly.
Right? I can do whatever I want. And I'm like, what?
There's no question of purity anymore after that, because it's being only linked to abstinence, which is not at all sort of, you know, that wholesome view of sin and redemption that is emerging.
I think part
Bible.
Of the problem with purity culture is that it's trying to deal with just one problem, one issue.
Right.
And
it elevates that one issue.
Yes. In absence or not considering anything else. And so, it is trying to respond to a real pain that comes out of, mm-hmm. you know, when people get kind of sucked into lust, or they're doing things that they shouldn't do. It does damage us, right? Yeah. It does hurt us and hurt others. And so they want to deal with that. But it's the pendulum swing in the other direction, you know, that in itself causes pain and dissociates people from their faith is maybe even the reason that they feel shame, or that shame just kind of sticks to them for so long. And they just like, oh, well, I was supposed to be pure, but because I wasn't pure, then I can't go to church now. I can't, I can't hang out with my friends anymore because they're pure and I'm not. And, and then what's, you know, with the purity thing, why is it just, you know, sex? There's so many other things that we're talking about six other deadly sins, and there's other things beyond that, right? That just cause us to be impure. It's not just sex.
Right. Yeah. Right? Yeah.
So what about all those things? Mm-hmm. And what is, and so what's the answer?
Yeah. Yeah. And Johanna, you were telling me before, you know, that it creates some differences between like the way that we treat women and the way that we treat men. So I wonder if you can reflect on that a little bit more.
I mean, I guess purity culture, like, it's kind of enforced unequally, mm-hmm. because women are encouraged to, you know, be chaste and modest for the most part, and men, from what I've observed, not as much, mm-hmm. if at all. It's more of like, you know, go get him, tiger. I don't know. What do you say to your bro before they go out and like get some? I don't know.
Why are you looking at me?
Like, I'm the only dude here, but.
Oh my gosh.
But yeah, like it's kind
go
of.
Go get
like,
them, tiger. That's what I say to all my bros before they go out on a date.
Yeah, well, like it's unfair how it's like it's not proportional at all, mm-hmm. and so you encourage the women to be chaste, and you encourage
the men to chase. Yeah. And it just kind of like leads to an unhealthy kind of culture of like, I think the word you used was rape culture. Yeah.
Right. It creates this dynamic where, consensual sex is hard to have because women always have to say no and men always have to say yes.
Yeah.
Because it's presumed that men are inherently more sexual, right?
Yeah.
Which, it creates this like, power imbalance.
Yeah. And I just don't think that's fair, I guess.
Yeah, for sure.
It's not fair.
So,
but can you say that again, that phrase again? Because I don't like it, but I love it. being chased and...
you encourage women to be chased.
To be chased?
Yeah, and then you encourage men to chase.
To chase. Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's a great turn of phrase that just kind of nails that whole situation. So thank you. Thank you for that.
Yeah. So we've talked about all of these problems, all of these less than helpful ways to talk about sexuality and lust. So what are some helpful ways? What's a way forward to talk about this? Because we do need to talk about it, I think.
Yeah.
So how do we do that well?
I think you need to speak about sexuality as good in that long committed relationship, right? Part of the issue with purity culture is how much it just pretended the relationship itself was not the problem. It was sex that was the issue alone.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But, to have a positive, like there is a good reason to wait until marriage, right? Mm-hmm. For sex. And that reason has to do with the fact that biblically, the coming together of two people sexually creates a union that is meant to be permanent.
Mm.
Right. And the other thing, so that's one element of it. And the other element of it is that it is God who created marriage. And so he is part of this story of you and someone else, of two people coming together. Right. And so as you think about his creation of sex, his creation of marriage, his creation of bringing two people together, right, you're not just two people doing it on just a purely human plane, right? God's involved there. And so marriage begins to be something that, it integrates all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And which is why sex should occur within that context, right?
Right, yeah.
So there are really good reasons for articulating that sex within marriage.
Right.
The whole person coming into a relationship with another whole person in relation to what God has created.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I like that. So the distinction you're sort of making there, because in some ways, talking about sex inside of marriage does seem to mirror purity culture.
It does.
But what you're sort of saying is like, it's actually in this context of whole life.
Yes.
Right? It's not just in this context of sex inside of marriage because it's safer and it's meeting these certain rules. It's no sex inside of marriage because it's in the context of like committed relationships.
Yes.
It's in the context
loving,
of
loving, faithful, sacrificial,
right.
Relationship.
And you're making the point that not all marriages are committed relationships.
Sure. Yes.
Right. So I mean the important thing is the committed relationship. And in the context of marriage, when that is a committed relationship, that all works.
Right. A healthy committed relationship where you're doing all of life together.
Yeah. So vulnerability. You can't just say marriage.
Sure.
Right? Because that's not a good experience for a lot of people.
Right.
It hasn't turned out well for a lot of people. So it's not a good idea or, a good example.
Sure.
But what we're trying to say is that marriage in a committed, healthy relationship where two people love each other and care for each other and are committed to one another, right?
Yeah. And it's something you grow into even within marriage, right? With sex being very much that sort of coming together intentionally. So it doesn't pretend like everything's going to be fine just because you said some words at an altar. It's that is the ideal that we need very much God to be holding us as we go forward. And sex is part of that story, right?
Yeah.
Hence, so I think the church really needs to articulate that healthy vision.
Yeah.
For us to make sense of why maybe sex out of marriage isn't great.
Right.
Why hookup culture isn't great. Why porn isn't great. Right.
Yeah.
You have to create that beautiful God-created vision.
Right.
Then you can recognize easier where the distortions lie.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not going to articulate it, it just feels like a whole lot of nonsensical rules.
Yes.
And very constraining and limited.
Yep.
Right? And so that would be perhaps a place to start. You know, what's the goodness here?
So I would say we need to start even before that, because if you are lucky, blessed enough to have a partner where you can figure that stuff out with, that's great. But what about as a single person or a young person, you know, before marriage, or a single person who goes through life unmarried?
Yeah.
Like, what is a healthy sexual understanding of yourself? Mm-hmm. I think that's really important, and maybe even necessary, in order to find that other person who you can then partner with and share that intimacy with in a committed relationship, right? But I think lust, we can overcome lust, single or married, by first looking at it ourselves, right? We need a holistic, healthy sense of sexualities for ourselves, and a basic respect and regard for everyone else. I think both those things are really important. We need to understand ourselves, and we need to care and respect other people. And so we need to look inside and develop that character, you know, a discipline of it's like what Rob said in the sermon, is ahead of time, figure out what sex means to you, figure out what, you know, what that relationship is. So that when something happens, you know, you already know where you stand, right? What you believe. That is so important. That's so crucial. 'Cause in the, you know, and Rob said, in the back of a backseat of a steamy vehicle, maybe you're not.
That's not the place.
That's not the place to be thinking what your theology of sex is.
Right.
So we need to look inside, and then I think also we need to look outside, and just understand the culture that we're in, and how it affects us, right? And that's part of what I said about respecting other people, because I think why a relationship is so important, if you care for other people, if you know other people, if you're in a relationship with other people, it's really hard to then begin to think of them as an object, right? And so one of the things that I say to guys is be in relationship with people, get to know people, like whether we're talking about, you know, sexual objects or not, that, you know, getting to know is a way to humanize people, right? I mean, you've seen in the movies, a little off topic, but you've seen in the movies where, you know, someone has a gun to the head of a main character or some other character, and then that person says, well, you know, my name's John, and I have kids, and I have, like, what are they trying to do? They're establishing a relationship.
Right.
With
They're building
that person,
a connection.
Building a rapport, building a connection, so that the person is less likely to kill, shoot, and kill them.
Right.
And so similarly, you know, in this sexual context of lust, right? When we get to know the person, we're less likely to feel lust or towards that person. And I mean, I'm not saying it won't happen. It can't happen.
Sure.
But I just, that relationship, developing of that relationship rapport and the respect from person to person that develops, makes it less likely to then pull the trigger.
Right.
And feel lust or act lustily, you know, towards that person.
So the last thing I would just say there is, like, we talk about lust and sexual sin as if they're, like, the worst of all the sins. I think you sort of alluded to this earlier. And so I would just say we need to emphasize grace.
Yes.
We need to recognize that lust, that sexual sin, is not an unforgivable sin.
Yep.
Right? It's something that falls within that context of grace. In the last couple minutes, I want us to just think about, okay, so that's a sort of general framework. What are some really practical things that we can do if we find ourselves struggling with lust, or even just living in this culture of hypersexualization? So we've been doing this fasting course here. And that's been, fasting is a practice that happens throughout Lent, you know, giving up food or giving up other things as a way of sort of focusing our hearts on God. But John Mark Comer, who leads this series, one of the things that he says is that whenever he's sort of counseling someone who is struggling with sexual sin, he will encourage them to fast from food.
Wow. Okay.
As a way of training your body and your mind to say, I don't need to give in to every bodily desire and pleasure.
Wow. Okay.
Right? That,
wow.
that he makes that, that connection. So I thought that was really interesting. Yeah.
I saw that Rob also made the connection between lust and like disordered eating. Mm-hmm. And it made me think of like, I guess, a solution, which would be like, okay, so you know how some people will go on a diet and they'll think of like chocolate and pizza and candy as
while
like
they're
bad.
On the diet. Yeah.
And then they'll think of like kale smoothies as good. And so that's like prescribing like morality onto food. It's just food. Versus like, I think you could also say that for sex is that like, it's just, it's not, it doesn't make you a bad person or a good person to engage in sex. And I feel like if we could think of that, then it would make people feel more comfortable.
Right. It's all about the context, right? Yeah. Cake is good sometimes. If you have cake all day, every day, maybe that's a problem.
Yeah.
That's a problem?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. So other practical practices.
I wanted to suggest that, and I've done this in the past for myself, and is an accountability partner.
Yeah.
It's just making a commitment with one other, well, in my case, it was another guy. I would just suggest that guy and female, girl guy, something is the more appropriate for this particular kind of accountability partnership.
Sure.
But the so you know, I've over the years I've had various friends who I've committed to kind of keep each other accountable to this kind of thing. And I just, if I can just end with a verse, because I think there's a verse that that really kind of it speaks to this, and it's Romans 12:2, and it says, do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, his good, pleasing, and perfect will. And I think that, in terms of practical ways to respond to this, it's the warning is don't conform to the pattern of this world. Don't get sucked into the hyper-sexualized culture, right? But instead, transform your heart and your mind according to the will of God, and just and that and then that becomes what your desire and your will is. Your own desires come into closer alignment with what God wants for us, for ourselves, and for others and the world. And I think if we can start to practice this, then I think we've got to.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Bill, so much for that. And thank you for listening to us this week on Trinity Talks. I hope that you found some helpful tidbits and things to take away. And we'd love to hear from you as well. We'll see you again next week.